Hello, we are the Makes History with me, Foz, and Ross. Say hello, Ross.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm saying how you doing. You didn't say that. You fucking love it. How you doing?
Yeah, no, I'm pretty good. I don't have a fun or exciting story to lead into. Apart from, nothing really.
Oh, lovely. Just working shit. Oh.
But tell me about your big adventure. The Big Foz Mystery Tour to the Ludder, Scotland.
Oh, yeah. So in Scotland with some one of Lex's close friends and a fella that I've known. They've been together for, like 8 years or something. It's a long time. Don't know how long it's been. So I've known him a long time as well. He's a good lad, Scottish. So we went to the village where his mum and dad live for the week, basically. We drove on Saturday and then... come back Thursday, and it's another matter of time, but I'd run out of holiday basically. So I had the full week off, which sucked, but yeah, I'd run out. I had to basically cancel the bank holiday, so I've got to work. It should be bank holiday Friday and Monday, and I've got to work both of them in order just to get that.
Oh man, I'm going to be sending you pictures of me sitting in my pants drinking beer.
Fucking good, man. It was lovely, mate. It was such a nice time, just super chill, like saw loads of wildlife and that. Like, just mad stuff. It's just mad stuff everywhere. The centre of this village where we were, it was like this beautiful waterfall, like massive waterfall, like over rocks. And it was amazing. It was just like the centre of the village. You get to see that every day. It's beautiful.
Nice.
Right on the edge of a lock. Like, did some nice walks and that. It was just...
That, of course, is the waterfall where they judge the newborn children, decide if they keep it or dash it over the edge.
Yeah. But it's a nice well off.
And it's good because that ensures the crops grow, which is nice.
Yeah. Oh, we actually saw an ancient burial ground of this clan. I can't remember the name of them, but it was like 800 AD. So it was like years ago. It was like their ancient burial ground. Beautiful, mate. It was lovely. It was good. I had a good time. Nice, relaxing chill.
Yeah, nice.
So, what are you drinking then? What you got on the go?
So, I've got a new one today. This is a Litovel, which is apparently from Moravia. Never heard of it, never seen it. But this was apparently Czech Beer of the Year 2023.
Show me the bottle.
The camera's out.
Yeah, that's going to sound something. Well, okay.
I mean, it has this Czech beer with you. It doesn't actually say like the name of the competition. It just has a gold medal with like a, in the about year 2000 when you had like, IT fonts in Word, you had like Comic Sans. You had that one sci-fi font. It's in that, so I assume that means it's really authentic.
Oh, okay. And what is it like?
It's not great, to be honest. It's like kind of doesn't really taste it very much. It's
oh dear.
No, there's not a lot going on there.
No, I've got it.
Just kind of watery, which is weird because it's 4.5% beer.
Okay.
Yeah, disappointed.
Maybe you've got a stronger taste in beer nowadays, brother.
Yeah, you try something new and it's disappointing and shit, so you shouldn't have tried.
that's the saying as well.
I'm going to have that like stitched onto a little thing and have it on the wall. What have you got?
I'm on Thatcher's Blood Orange Cider.
Ooh.
It is proper nice. And to pair it off, I've got an actual orange as well. You know what I mean? I just thought that was a mad combo. I saw it sat on the side and I was like, that's a mad combo, I'm going to go for that.
That is very citrusy. You are going to be safe from scurvy.
Well, I hope so. That's the plan anyway, because I plan on doing some piracy. I've already drew up the plans for the boat. Just to be clear, not online piracy.
Actual physical piracy.
Actual physical piracy. I'm going to go do some looting. I'm going to get very nutritious. But obviously, because we live in Birmingham, because I live in Birmingham, we've only got the canal, so I've had to build a canal boat, unfortunately.
Canal Park.
I'm just going to go terrorise the locals of Birmingham and all the tourists, basically.
Boarding Rosie and Jim.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm just painting my orange at the moment, mate. Maybe that
yeah,
might. I thought it would be like, do you know what I mean? That's my thing. Yeah, so it's been a while since we've done a recording. It's been a while since we released anything off. To be honest, we sat here forgetting we're on a podcast, to be honest. it's been ages. Where did we get to? I genuinely don't remember.
So last time, we talked about Albert Speer, the architect turned armaments minister turned guy who got fucking away with all of the war crimes.
What a wanker.
Yeah.
Oh.
God.
No, oh, no, you just... my orange, mate.
I thought that was like, I'm going to say something, but no, it's like, orange.
Nice orange, man. Good orange.
Sweet so, yeah, orange. So we looked at, like, you know, how the Nazis kind of put the economy onto, like, more of a sort of rational war footing, sort of. And we established that you can achieve, you know, lots of production if you're willing to fucking bury the problem in slave labour.
Mm, yeah.
And the big context of it all was the Germans basically understood that in the summer of 1942 was their last opportunity to win the war on their terms, right? They understood it was win it that year or they would fall behind economically.
Yeah.
So the big centrepiece of that is a push into the Caucasus, and to get there to control the oil meant taking the like railway hub on the way, which was in a place called Stalingrad. So in 1942, the German army enters.
Pretty into important place.
Yeah, so it's like the importance of Stalingrad is because it's on the railway network into the south, and they.
And it's named after the man.
And it's named after the main man himself, Captain Moustache. You know. Mm. Mario's twisted brother.
What, was Wario? But no, we were wrong. It's Stalin. Big reveal.
So yeah, so this is, you know, the centrepiece for Germany's 1942 plan. The thing, everything hinges on. First, do you want to tell the ladies and gentlemen listening how the Battle of Stalingrad worked out for the Germans?
Not well. I've been there in a computer game.
You had me there for a second. So I'm sure you've been there.
No, like on the front lines of that battle, of that war, of that conflict.
Thank you for your service in Call of Duty.
Lots of people died. A lot of people died there. I can tell you firsthand from computer games.
So yeah, so in 1942 they get bogged down in Stalingrad, and basically during the winter and going into 1943. The German army in Stalingrad is surrounded and destroyed completely.
Annihilated.
Yeah. The battle cost the Axis, because also the Hungarians, Italians and Romanians over as well, it cost them 1.5 million dead.
Wow. That is a lot of people.
So it's not a great start to 1943 for Hitler, and it gets worse.
I wonder what that was as a percentage of the military. Like,
that's a big chunk. That's a big chunk. I think that's top of my head figure. I think it's about 10% of the.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. And the news kind of got worse in that first few months of 1943, because about the same time, there's been a bit of a to do going on in North Africa between the British and the Germans.
Oh yeah.
And basically, this comes to its conclusion. So the Germans are bottled up in Tunisia, so like the sticky up part of North Africa closest to Italy, and basically the British and Commonwealth forces from the east and British and American forces landing in the west have trapped Rommel and the Afrika Korps in Tunis. And in 1943, they surround and destroy what's left of the Afrika Korps. And again, 300,000 men are captured when Tunis falls. So it's still a big chunk of manpower. Now, one of the dumbest things about this is when the Allies are closing in, so they're being... closing in on like three sides, it's obvious they're falling back to this one city, it's obvious they're going to be trapped. What do you think Hitler's response to the situation? Your armies are falling back on a single city, everything bearing down on them, hopelessly outnumbered.
What did Hitler do? Something ridiculous. really yeah, ridiculous.
He tried to reinforce it. He sent in shit tons of planes. So,
can't accept it. He's just a madman.
He just cannot.
You've got a city left. Like, how can you fight out of a city and take a continent?
Yeah, no, he believes...
Well, he thought, it's all that cocaine, but he thought it was Superman, then.
It's literally, he's just, like, moving things on a map and it's not connected. So he reinforces it with, like, the cream of the Luftwaffe and the Italian Air Force. So when Tunis falls, they lose 3,000 aircraft destroyed or captured.
Wow, that is a big chunk as well.
It's a huge chunk, 3,000 in one go.
Do you know what that's like in comparison to the Allied losses?
What I can compare it to, if I just skim ahead, is monthly production.
Mm.
I think that's equivalent to, like, at peak, a month production.
Oh, wow.
In one go. And obviously, you don't just lose the planes, you lose the pilots.
You lose pilots, which are after train.
Exactly. You're losing all those experienced map out. And, like, you lose the experienced pilots. Those are the ones who would also be training the next generation of pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fucking... double massive blow. Stalingrad obviously gets a lot of attention, but Tunis, at the time they actually referred to it as Tunisgrad, because it was just as heavy a blow to the Luftwaffe as Stalingrad was to the army. And, okay, so we've talked about the army, we've talked about the Air Force, now we'll also, at the same time, mention what's happening to the Navy.
I was going to say, we're talking about a loss of subs on this.
Yeah, so you know, Germany's been running this submarine campaign trying to cut off and starve the UK into submission, right?
Which now, makes, I think that is a good strategy, I think, to be honest. But
it is.
It's not if you want to invade. If you want to piss them off, yeah, but...
the problem with it is they could never, even at the height of their success, they could never sink enough ships. They couldn't sink them as quickly as the Allies could replace them.
Mm.
Especially after the Americans entered the war, like they're just pumping ships out. By the time we get to, like, the spring of 1943, Allied technology, Allied techniques are getting better and better, and the tide has clearly swung in the Allied favour. Like, they have sonar, they have radar, they have, you know, advanced weapons on their destroyers for hunting down and sinking the destroyers.
Great British invention.
Exactly. Radar. Yeah, radar and sonar. You know, they've figured out the techniques of hunting down and destroying the submarines. They're reading the messages between German HQ and the submarines in real time. They know what they're doing.
British invention.
Breaking the Enigma.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, we are British. We get bad rep. Ooh.
Yeah, hold on to that thought, because there's... I probably should have mentioned this earlier. Fucking content warning for this episode. Seriously, there's some unpleasant stuff coming.
Thanks, bruv.
Yeah. I should have mentioned at the start, but I'm, you know, professional, stupid talking about my beer. But yeah, actually, seriously, like, content warning for this episode, there is some unpleasant stuff in this. Anyway, so for the submarines. So all of this comes together, and in May 1943, the Germans get to a point where they're losing one submarine every day. During May, they lose 20% of the entire fleet.
I was going to say, that's not... It won't take a year to do the fleet, would it?
Yeah, no. If on that rate, it would have been less than 6 months and they would have been out the war.
Mm.
So at that point, with a submarine going down every day, which is like 60, 70 men aboard every submarine.
Submarine loss, it was the highest. You had like a 1 in 5 chance of coming back or something at one
point. No, you had a 1 in 10 chance of coming back.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the U-boats had the proportionally worst survival rate of any unit during World War II.
And there was one guy that did like 5 missions, who was a hero.
Yeah, like all of their famous like captains died, pretty much all of them. So basically at that point, Admiral Dönitz, the commander of the Kriegsmarine, basically admits defeat and he orders the wolf packs back to port. The Kriegsmarine is basically out of the war at this point.
Mm.
All right, so you are Adolf Hitler. You got these disasters going on. What do you think would be your kind of response to this? Like, you're looking at military defeat in the Med, in Eastern Europe, at sea. Everything is starting to come crashing down.
I'd be trying to peace out for what I've got old at this point, I think. I'd be like, well, we're not getting no more, so we need to try and just...
Get the
peace... Yeah, best conditions we can. Because obviously we've got massive gains at the moment compared to what we had. at the start of the war, Macedonians, territorially, and their towards their ethics as well of, you know, cleansing and, you know, in their they've done a good job so far, haven't they? They reckon.
They've done what they've set out to do.
You'd think they would logically, they'd be trying to be like, okay, guys, how much do you want back? Do you know what I mean? That's what Hitler would be saying.
So but Hitler
wouldn't he definitely wouldn't be saying that because he's a fucking lunatic. So I don't know what. Go on. What was he saying?
So Hitler and Speer put their heads together and they decide the solution to all of this is what they came up with was the Adolf Hitler Panzer Program. We're going to build shit tons of tanks and that's going to be the number one focus.
Yeah, it's where the Tigers start piling out and King Tigers and ridiculous Tigers and elephants and
all exactly, the cool stuff. Yeah. Everything gets bigger and better and everything goes into the tanks. So the target will be to produce 2,000 tanks and other armoured vehicles per month. The kind of the showpiece of this is going to be more than 1,000 Panthers every month.
Yeah. Oh, what a beautiful tank to look at.
It is a good looking tank. That's what a tank should look like.
Yeah. Shame it's the fucking metal
six. Like, interestingly, the French army tried adopting the Panther after the war, like using the captured examples. Yeah. Fucking disaster. They're like, no, this thing does not work. And they just canned them off and scrapped
it. Yeah, none of them did really. They all had big problems. Tigers had big. I think the Tiger.
Tiger
was
one
the, was the blast of the good tanks.
Yeah. I think it's the last one where it worked.
Yeah, it was a functional because King Tigers had massive, massive problems. And there was only a handful of them anyway. There was like 300 of them. Man, I think it was a ridiculous low number.
Something like that.
And then got like Sturm Tiger as well.
Free produced.
Yeah. These things are cool and that, but they're not real. They're not real. A lunatic puppet's production for a couple of days, basically.
Pretty much.
And then they come out and they're like, yeah, it's really cool, look at this new tank, and then everyone, this is what you're fighting against. But in reality, they made three. Yeah. So why didn't they just say they made them? That probably would have been more efficient. It saved them a lot of money.
I mean, that's basically what they're doing, though. It's all about the propaganda value. Again, like, Speer's, like, you know, this architect and theatre designer sort of guy. It's all about the show, the big, cool-looking tanks. Let's have loads of them. Yeah, it's going to be really awesome. So they throw everything at tanks. So they, like, throw all the resources. Remember last time we talked about how, like, they rationalised the resources. They got rid of all of these, like, you know, inflation of the urgency. Nah, that's gone fucking out the window. We're back at that. Everything goes to the tanks. Workers in the tank factories are spared from being called up. Soldiers who've been mobilised are demobilised to go back to the factory. They go on to 72-hour working shifts, and they get priority on all subcomponents. So if you think of stuff like, you know, crankshafts, fucking everything is using that. No, tanks. Now, undeniably, there was a massive increase in both the number of tanks produced and the relative quality. Like, a Panther is obviously not a Panzer II. It's a world of difference.
Mm.
But tanks are only a small part of your war effort. You can't just have tanks and nothing else.
Yeah.
And this focus on tanks harmed literally everything else.
Mm.
Like, you're not producing trucks if all the crankshafts are going to the tanks. You're not producing planes if the engines are going there. And that's even
the
big
one, trucks. Logistics are so important. If you can't get the stuff there, you may as well not have ever had it.
Exactly. And even, like, knock-on effects. So, like, all the railway lines are taken up moving shit for producing tanks.
Yeah.
So stuff like coal being shipped out the Ruhr is waiting because someone's moving tanks around. And the end result of all of this is we get back to exactly where we were 12 months earlier, where we had, like, you know, everything was a priority, so therefore nothing was. Now everything is tanks. And to get round this, we start getting, like, some real fucking absurd shit happening. So the Luftwaffe starts to describe its aircraft orders as tank orders to get them built. Cheers. So they're literally describing aeroplanes as panzers. It's the only way to prioritise parts.
That's mad, that is, isn't it? The whole thing's a fucking shit show, isn't it? I know I say it's fairly regular. I say it probably every 30 minutes on this podcast recently. But it's fucking mad how this even fucking got to this stage.
It is.
This fucking dog and pony act, they call the fucking Nazi part. You know what I mean?
But, yeah.
Lots of dudes. Lots of dudes, aren't there?
basically, that's it. It's like lots of dudes, and if you move before everyone else does, you get the advantage. But like
it's just a bunch of fucking idiots. Like, basically, a bunch of idiots that are really, really, really evil.
Yeah. Like, if it wasn't so fucking tragic, it would be extremely funny, it's so frustrating and annoying, this entire fucking story, because it's just dumb. Like, World War One, it's tragic and pointless and futile and shit, but also you understand, like, there's strategic logic going on.
This is just
fucking stupid.
Yeah. Like, they were all strategic players in World War One. Everyone was, it was strategy, weren't it? They weren't there.
Yeah.
Obviously, millions of people died over just... It's still lunacy that millions, you know,
they all
died because of it. But they were strategically trying to, like, put moves against each other.
There's a logic and a reason as to why it happened. Whereas this is just fucking stupid.
Yeah. Time, man, but this is like...
But it's like, literally, this is the event that made the modern world. And it's the stupidest fucking thing that could have happened.
Imagine the aliens when they look at us. And they know about this. They learn about World War II.
This is why they don't talk to us.
Yeah, probably. This is probably why they don't, really. Because they probably wouldn't want to, would they, in reality.
If you had this fucking, you know, this is the equivalent of having the house next door to you. It's got a fucking burned out sofa in its front yard. And
yeah.
You don't invite them to the barbecue, do you?
Nah, they don't get invited. Sorry, mate, took us way off track there.
I don't think it's a good point. Anyway, so on the topic of air power, we'll come back to that. So, I mean, it's been a motivating thing, like, from way back from the first episode of the series we've been talking about, that this fear about a future war was going to put Germany up against British and American air power in this, air war of the future. And especially in the years before the war, there was this idea, this famous quote from British Prime Minister, which was, "The bomber will always get through." The idea that the future of war is the bombing of cities, right? And in the first years of the war, like, obviously Britain and Germany are bombing each other, the Battle of Britain, there's a thing, the bombing of Coventry, the Blitz, and so on. It doesn't really do that much damage. Obviously, Coventry gets fucked up, but Coventry's a small and, like, medieval city in them days, so it's particularly vulnerable. But, like, the bombing of London, bombing of Birmingham, Belfast and places, doesn't really achieve that much. And it's the same in the early year wars of, like, the British bombing German cities. The planes are too small. They don't have the engine power. They don't do enough damage. They don't carry enough bombs. Also, the advantages are with the Defender. The powerful flat guns, the radar, fighters. It really limits what the bomber's going to achieve, right? And, you know, we also talked about this in the pre-war episodes where Germany put everything into the Ju-88 bomber program for these twin-engine bombers.
Yeah, that was the old days,
Yeah, but, you know, that was such a huge, huge focus. Then it's like, oh, wait, these don't do enough damage. They don't hit cities hard enough.
Yeah.
And this was a problem in the first years of the war. Now, the Germans, to be fair, did try and build a, like, proper strategic bomber. Now, Foz, you're an engineering guy, right? Obviously, you're not an aircraft engineer. If you're thinking of, like, a strategic bomber, something that's for the purpose of wrecking the economy of cities, destroying factories, infrastructure...
Big payload.
What else would you be thinking? What's your main focuses?
Distance. You need to get there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, better range. You want a long range. Obviously, fighters can't keep up with you normally, so you want good armaments, good payload. You know, because you're going to be a target as well.
Yeah.
Especially under the belly from all the flak. So, as much protection as you can sort of offer the plane as well in the same way.
Okay. How high on your list would you put dive bombing as an ability?
For wrecking cities?
Yeah, for like a big, massive...
That's close air support, man. That's different. That's a different game.
Do you want to get what the Germans did?
They make a cool sound, though. They do make a cool sound when they come down. The German dive bombers, so not the Ju-87s. That was a big one. They had a siren on them, didn't they?
Yeah, Jericho siren.
The Jericho siren. And I think its only purpose was to fucking terrify people. Psychological warfare,
yeah.
Because you knew one was coming down in the area where you're at. It made this really high-pitched fucking scream.
Yeah. Yeah, like a film Dunkirk's really got a good demonstration of that going on.
They are terrifying though, to be fair. Playing in the game, like we play a lot of like World War II games, like from strategy to first person shooters. And in any game, when you hear that sound, you're like, oh shit, what's going on? There's one coming down on me.
So the Germans, like, okay, they looked at their bomber fleet, they looked at the Ju-88s, the Hu-111s, like, okay, these are too small and light, so we're going to build a four-engine strategic bomber, the Heinkel Hu-177.
Yeah.
Hitler insisted this plane must be able to dive bomb.
What the fuck, man? How a plane that big could dive bomb? Impossible.
So for like non-military listeners, dive bombing is like when the plane comes screaming down from high altitude to like 100 foot or so off the deck to drop a single bomb on a specific tank.
Yeah.
And if you imagine a plane like a modern day B-52, Hitler's trying to make this do that. Unsurprisingly, there's a fucking tension in the design between the need for, as you say, like long range payload, and Hitler's desire that this plane should be able to go very fast in a straight line down.
And make a noise.
I know this will come as a shock, but it didn't work.
No.
The Allies, on the other hand.
Did they not know about none of this, like the Allies at the time? Or they probably knew everything, so were they not just laughing at him, like, how's he done this?
It never went into, like, mass production, because the engineers from Heinkel just could not make it work. Like, the engines had burst into flames, had all sorts of fucking design problems. Like, also, like, you know, you think of, like, a four-engined Allied bomber, like a B-17 or a Lancaster, you're like, you know, you have four distinct engines on the wing,
yes,
right?
Yes, very big, large engines.
They took two engines and stuck them together into, like, one structure called a nacelle. They stuck it together. So the two engines are, like, heating each other up. One has a fault, it affects the other one, and it just made it a fucking mechanical nightmare.
Okay.
Project never worked. But the British, they, from 1942, start producing four-engine bombers that do work. The Lancaster, the Halifax, the Stirling. And they start producing them in serious numbers. So from 1942 onward, the raids on German cities start getting bigger. British moved to a nighttime bombing to reduce the risk from German fighters. And by 1942, they're hitting Germany with up to 1,000 bombers in a night.
Wow.
You bear in mind, like, each bomber's like a 10-man crew, something like that. So it's like basically an entire division worth of men in bombers every night over Germany.
And those bombers carry a lot of fucking bombs, man.
Yes.
Like, I know there's various different sizes, but these can drop, like, fucking...
We're talking several tons,
Like, several thousand tons of bomb. Some of them can. Like, they could be dropping one-ton bombs and have four of them. Like, the biggest bees that anything could.
Like, the biggest RAF bombs are, like, 4,000-pound bombs.
Uh-huh.
They excavated one of these from the river in Cologne a couple of years ago and had to evacuate something like 30,000 people because it's just such a massive fucker. So Cologne gets hit with 1,000 bombers on the 30th of May 1942, which is the first really big raid. But in 1943, this is going to stop being one-offs and it's going to become systematic. And these bombers are going to start hitting the German economy hard. So Bomber Command...
An already restricted economy.
Yeah, exactly. Not in a bomb that's already, before any bombers are landing on it, is in fucking severe trouble.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a really important point you're making. So we've got to keep in mind is this economy does not function properly. Even if we take away any bombing pressure, it doesn't function like an economy is supposed to. And now, from 1943, the thumb screws are coming on. So they begin what's called the Battle of the Ruhr. And it begins on March 1943 with nearly 400 bombers hitting Essen. Essen is a particular target because where Krupp's steel factory is. Essen becomes the most bombed city in Germany, I think.
Is that on the coast, Essen?
No, it's in the Ruhr, so it's like along the, the river.
On the river, yeah.
Along the rivers directly facing France.
Okay.
So in this raid, 14 aircraft are lost. While on the ground, around 500 people are killed, with more than 3,000 houses destroyed in a single night. To give you an idea of the accuracy, only 40% of the aircraft dropped their bombs within 3 miles of the factory that was the target.
My. Why is it so bad?
They're flying high at night with bombs with no guidance or speed control or anything, just hoofing them into the general area. And it's like,
so
only
safe, basically.
Yeah, just yeah, they go high and they go at night to try and reduce range. Risk. Exactly. But it's just the limitations of the technology. Like, from high up, you just, like, the 4,000-pound bomb is literally just a big fuck-off barrel full of explosives. They're just hoofing it out there. So, like, the accuracy rates are appalling. When people talk about, like, oh, precision bombing in World War II, it's like, precision bombing is, oh, it landed within a mile.
Mm. Wow. That's unreal, that is.
So, unlike the previous raids, this massive raid on Essen is followed up. And so, for night after night, there are more and more attacks on cities in the Ruhr. So each night, we have the mass formations of the heavy bombers, and then during the daytime, they had a light bomber called the Mosquito, which was a kind of a British specialty. It was made mostly out of wood, extremely fast, much faster than the German fighters. You know, it's made of wood, so it had reduced radar cross-section. And they could just kind of appear, harass during the daytime, keep the gunners on their toes, and then in the evening, heavy attacks from these big fleets of bombers.
Okay.
And so during this kind of focus on Essen, on the Ruhr during March of 43, they drop a total of 34,000 tons of bombs.
Fucking hell.
Yeah. And targeting steel production, and targeting coal mines, targeting coking, and also kind of the subcomponent manufacturers. So, like, okay, you have Krupp's massive factory, but also you have Hans's crankshaft manufactury with, like, 6 guys. If that gets hit, you're fucked, because no one else is producing...
Well, to be fair, when you're dropping that much tonnage of bomb in the local vicinity as well, how do you get anything in and out the factory?
Exactly, you're fucking...
Because you've obliterated everything, like, the rails... Exactly. The rail only needs one brake for it not to work. So the rail system's out, because it's been fucking peppered up nicely, you know what I mean? Like, there's going to be several breaks throughout it. That's not going to get repaired anytime soon.
Hold on to that thought, because that's going to come really important later.
Okay.
Because railways, you can repair them. Like, if the track itself, you can repair, and it's not.
When you're dropping that many bombs on it every day, like, I can't. You'd have to be repairing it every day.
Yeah, exactly. It's
you've
like
got that much of a spread on the bombage.
Exactly. Bombage, you're trying to like
bombage.
Bombage, yeah. You measure it in bombage. But exactly, you think how big of a job that is, fixing up the track every day, and at the same time, the same factories in the same area are supposed to be producing the tanks and everything else.
Yeah. Like, they're getting bummed.
You're only producing one of these, like, you know, you can do one or the other.
Yeah.
So the growth in armaments is basically crippled. So, like, Speer's measures had produced growth. From now on, it, like, flatlines as a result of the bombing.
Mm.
Steel production falls by 200 tons. Aircraft production is flat for a year. To quote from Adam Tooze in The Wages of Destruction, Bomber Command stopped Speer's armaments miracle in its tracks.
Mm.
There's a lot of debate
about it.
They didn't know about it. It's the problem. RAF Bomber Command did not understand what they'd achieved.
Okay.
And this is going to be a little bit of a tragedy that comes up here. There's a lot of discussion and debate about the morality of the bombing campaign.
Of course, obviously, because millions, like, well, not millions, but a lot of people died.
Hundreds of thousands of people died.
But it's one of those, I think, as someone who is from a city where it was affected by it, like, I get it. I sort of do get it. I come from, you know what I mean? Like, obviously, it's horrendous, but I sort of get it. Like,
yeah, I mean,
not
I'm
nowadays,
gonna...
but I mean, yeah. Back then. You know,
you couldn't achieve like laser guided shit.
Yeah,
then.
That wasn't even a consideration back then. Nowadays, yeah. Like, no, that totally don't flow. Like, you can't just be bombing civilians. But back then, it's a different time. It was 100 years ago, not 100 years ago, but not far off.
80 years now, yeah.
A very long time. Different morality, different moral compass. That's what they
say.
Moral compass.
And I mean, I'm going to like stick my like colours to the mast in that, to me, Bomber Command and the bombing of German cities is a war-winning measure. Without it, the war goes on longer.
Yeah, well, almost certainly. Based on those facts that you just said about the figures, definitely. I have heard, like, people say before, that it made no difference. But I don't understand how dropping that many bombs over that big a size would make no difference. And the figures sort of show that. Like, no growth in a sector where you're spending all your money. Well, you're spending a lot of money.
This is it. People are looking to see, like, negative growth. But it's like, well, if you're pumping resources in, you're going to have growth. If you're pumping resources in and it's flatlining, that's basically negative growth.
Exactly.
So in the context of all of this disaster, Germany goes for, like, the last big roll of the dice in the East. And that's so they launch their last big offensive on the Eastern Front, their last attempt to take control at Kursk.
Kursk.
Yes, exactly. I'd like that you knew where I was going.
You're going to say that.
do you have some context?
You know why I know
Go
that?
On.
Because it's like the biggest tank battle that's ever been fought.
All right, that's do you want to give the context for the listeners?
Okay. Put me on the spot here, man, a little bit.
You seem too confident.
Okay. Yeah, obviously I know about Kursk. It's like just mad wiki tank battle. There's like, there's hundreds of crazy stories. There's who does a podcast about it, like a couple of episodes?
Lions Led by Donkeys.
Lions Led by Donkeys, yeah. By the way, they're awesome. We both listen to them, don't we?
Yeah, they're
awesome. You should check that out, anyone who's listening to us. Lions Led by Donkeys. Very similar thing. They talk about historical stuff on that. Like the geezers who are on it, like... When I say geezers, there's women and men. Like, I'm not being sexist or nothing. Either, you know...
Geezer is a gender-neutral term.
Yeah, geezers in general. They know a lot of stuff. They're cool. Pardon me, but yeah, so it's just a massive, massive basically push where my main man Yuri Zhukov just comes into town. He's a Russian tank commander. Well, what is he, field marshal at this point?
Field marshal, yeah.
Field marshal, who's the fucking biggest cock on the block. He just sorts answers out, then he basically.
Yeah, so Kursk is like this is like sticky outfit in the Russian line. So the Germans like. Look at this obvious weak spot. And your man, Zhukov, is like, ha-ha, look at this obvious weak spot. I'm sure they're going to attack this.
Yeah, which they did.
Which they did.
Lots and lots and lots of tanks and lots of men and lots of everything. It was a massive, massive battle. It's one of the bloodiest battles as well, weren't it?
Yeah, and I think it's the single biggest tank battle in history.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, it definitely is.
So on the 5th of July, the Germans go on the offensive. Like, the Soviets fully know they're coming. The Germans attack with 700...
With all the new call sheet as well.
Exactly. It's the combat debut of the Panther, of the Elephant, all of the new call sheet that Hitler's been pumping up with this Panzer program Adolf Hitler for the last 6 months or whatever. 2,000 tanks. Unfortunately, the Soviets have got the memo and they are going to meet 1.3 million Soviet soldiers armed with 5,000 tanks.
That are also well dug in. With traps laid for every single occasion. They had specialist dogs. This is something I learned after Lawrence Red Boy Donkey's podcast. They had the specialist dogs trained with a mowing strap to the back. And they trained them to run under the cap. So they captured a bunch of German tanks and trained them to run under those tanks only. And they'd run under the tank, the dog with a mowing strap to his back. So he basically. The mine blows up, obviously kills the dog and blows up the underside, which isn't armoured, of the tank.
We celebrate Comrade Lassie and her service.
Yeah, lots of dogs died from that, man. It was horrific.
But we saw that at the Bundeswehr Museum when we was in Dresden, wasn't it?
Yeah, we did. Oh, that was a good time, that was.
But they have a captured dog bomb.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as you might suspect from the way we've introduced this, Kursk ends in colossal failure for the Germans.
Big time.
And Hitler does not have, like, you know, a good Hitler summer in 1943. So 3 days after the Battle of Kursk begins, the Allies land in Sicily. So this one, the 8th of July.
Which doesn't get a lot of press, does it, the landing in Sicily? It's all about D-Day.
Yeah. It's like Sicily goes really easily and then Italy goes really badly. But in the initial landing in Sicily, like, Axis resistance collapses pretty quickly. And by the 25th of July, so like 3 weeks later...
Who was there on the Sicily invasion?
British and Americans, I think South Africans.
Oh, it's a good mix of the...
Everybody.
Good mix of the
All the lads.
Nice. All the All lads. Nice, I love that.
And so by 25th of July, 3 weeks later, Mussolini is overthrown in an internal coup in Italy.
Yeah, they fucking took him out of England, didn't they, when they finally got
that him. Happens later, but the king removes him from power.
Scout, they tracked him down, didn't they?
Yeah. So he doesn't get hanged until 1945, actually. But yeah, he's thrown out of power and removed, and there was kind of an opportunity here if the Allies had moved quickly to completely roll up Italy, but they dragged their heels, and then we get months and months of horrific fighting in the mountains.
Mm.
Turns out if you invade Italy, don't start at the bottom and work your way up. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, where none of the infrastructure is.
Let's invade the poorest part first.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just going to re-emphasise a little bit the content warning mentioned earlier. So the next section is going to involve descriptions of some unpleasant shit. So if you don't want to hear about people being burned, skip along for about 10 minutes in the podcast.
Can't skip along, mate. We're doing it live.
No, you don't get a choice. You've got to listen to the show. But yeah, this is going to be a little bit unpleasant. All right. So you ghoulish fucking people that are still listening to this. A few nights after Mussolini... Actually, no, the same night Mussolini had been overthrown, the RAF began attacking Hamburg, which was Germany's second biggest city. Mm. So Hamburg, if you're not familiar, it's port city up in northwest Germany on the North Sea. And this is Operation Gomorrah. And it would be several nights of bombing raids against the city, culminating in the biggest raid on the 27th of May. Now, Hamburg was a medieval city, like it's a Hanseatic city, so it's all like these wooden framed buildings, very densely populated, small, dense city centre.
Yeah.
It's also a port, so there's ports and docks full of fuel oil for ships. The weather recently had been very warm and very dry, unusually so for northwest Germany. And on the night of 27th, 777 bombers took off from the UK.
How many?
777.
That's the exact number, isn't
it? It is. 70 of them would not make a target. They dropped off for various reasons. So 707 would reach the target. You know, they had their targets for specific areas. You know, they would look at photographs and be shown this, you know, specific landmarks are, this is the target. So that's something recognisable, mm-hmm. right? And the targets were densely, very densely packed, working class residential neighbourhoods.
That was the target?
That was the target.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now, the RAF officially was never bombing for the purpose of killing German civilians. No, no, no. That would be uncivilised. What the RAF was doing, though, was dehousing German workers. Because if we blow up their houses, they'll be homeless and they won't be efficient at work.
Where are they going to be at, though?
Exactly. Exactly. There's only one answer of where they're going to be. In said houses asleep.
That's a no regard for human life decision, isn't it?
No, that's exactly. It's a PR gloss on deliberate targeting of civilians. Mm. So, of the bombs carried in these planes, 50% of the bomb mix were incendiaries, bombs which are designed to start fires, right? When they were dropped, they caused an inferno that swept across the city, and it became a fire that's so big and so intense, it created its own system of wind inside the fire.
Wow.
Basically, what it did was it made a tornado made out of fire.
Fuck.
This tornado got so big that it covered 21 square kilometres of the city and reached 1,000 feet into the air.
Fuck.
Literally a storm made out of fire. On the ground, the wind speeds reached up to 150 miles an hour.
But basically nuked then.
I think this maybe killed more people than Hiroshima, actually.
Wow.
So the wind speeds get up to 150 miles an hour. Again, winds literally made out of fire. The temperatures reached 800 degrees Celsius. It was so hot that glass melted and the streets reported to burst into flames. Oil from the broken fuel depots leaked into the canals and the canals caught fire. Because this fire was so intense, it basically burned all of the oxygen in the city. So people who were sheltering in the bomber shelters suffocated in their thousands.
Yeah.
Up to 40,000 people, I believe, have died in one night.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Didn't get taught that at school.
Mm-mm. This is sometimes referred to as the Hiroshima of Germany, and at this point it was the single deadliest air raid that had ever happened.
Yeah.
The RAF in future would become very good at producing these firestorms, as they were known, and repeating them. This was RF Bomber Command's like preferred method of destroying cities.
Wow. So that wasn't the only time they did that, or that was the worst time they did that?
This was probably the worst time they managed, and this was the first time they did it. But this is exactly what happened to Dresden as well. And other cities. They were doing it. They were doing it on the regular later. It was, and like I think one thing we noticed when we was in Dresden, like you walk through like all these like post war neighbourhoods and suddenly there's like an old church and you realise how big the old city was. Yeah, and there's nothing.
Yeah.
So this is the first time RAF Bomber Command is able to destroy a city in a single hit. The Nazi leadership honestly is kind of wobbling at this point. People are stunned by this. Nothing like it has ever happened. It's possible if they'd been able to follow it up that this maybe would have been something that could knock Germany out of the war.
Yeah, so I can imagine if you could hit Berlin with that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. So there's a few reasons why Bomber Command can't reproduce it. One is that Hamburg is very specific conditions. Yeah, it's a big medieval city. It has all this port infrastructure. Mm-hmm. There's conditions that make Hamburg go the way it does. There's also a desire to target locations around Germany. The idea that everyone in Germany suddenly feels they're at risk, bombs falling on their house, to collapse political support, right?
Yeah.
There's also, as you just taken us to, the guy in charge of Bomber Command, a guy named Arthur Harris, known as Bomber Harris, he wants to destroy Berlin because he believes it's going to knock Germany out of the war by destroying the capital. He goes into a massive effort and throws Bomber Command against Berlin night after night after night, but he's never able to achieve the success.
Oh, okay.
There's a few reasons for it. For one, Berlin is a much bigger city.
Much further away.
Much further away, at the far end of Bomber Command's reach, and much deeper into Germany.
The largest, biggest bombers, they won't have all the small bombers as well, like you said.
Yeah.
Hamburg is not that far from the UK. Really, is it? It's not that far a distance.
Exactly. Berlin and also,
it's more than twice, it's almost three times the distance, isn't it?
Yeah, something like this. Also, if you think, like, you know, the point when a bombers get picked up on radar, they're going to be in Hamburg soon. It's like on the coast. Yeah. Whereas once they're picked up and raided, they're flying to Berlin. Plenty of time to get the fighters in the air.
Mm-hmm.
The city itself is much more spread out. It's mostly built out of stone and concrete buildings rather than wood. So they're just not able to achieve the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
Bomber Command also pay a horrendous price for the war. 50% of Bomber Command's aircrew is lost.
Yeah.
Okay. End of the content warning section. If you listen, skip to that bit, you can safely come back in now.
I'm not surprised, but I am a little bit surprised based on my knowledge of World War II stuff that I don't know about that. I probably did hear, I must have heard about it at some point, but was it really not that talked about?
I don't think it is that talked about. Outside of like more specialist like media about the war, really, like, you know, if you watch like a 10-part documentary series, it's not going to mention it.
Yeah,
it's just you might get an episode that covers the bomber offensive.
Yeah, exactly.
But nothing that really gets into, and people always focus on Dresden, but like Dresden doesn't come close to Hamburg or Cologne in terms of what happened.
Yeah, it's weird, that is, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and the like the Nazi leadership, they believed if the bombing raids had kept up on the Ruhr, Germany would have been out of the war.
Mm.
Like, that was the nerve centre. Bomber Command took its focus away and it didn't follow up. The war probably could have been done in 1944 with more focus on the right targets.
But that means a massive cost of German life as well.
It does. And it's civilians. Let's not beat around the bush. It's people being killed in their homes.
Mm.
And of course, you know, as we've already said, the people working in the factories, they're not German. They're Eastern European captives.
So it's friendly fire, really, isn't it?
Where I live, like, for context, people that are joining the podcast at this point, I live in a small town in Czech Republic, and the villages around where I live all have war memorials from when they were bombed by the Americans during the war, trying to hit the oil refineries.
There is an oil refinery not too far from
here. Yeah, exactly. But that's
we pass it on the bus, don't we?
We do.
We pass it on the bus.
We do. biggest oil refinery in Czechoslovakia. That was at the time. And it was a prime target, even though it's, you know, occupied Czechoslovakia, who are ostensibly allied with the allied powers. Anyway, so there's an opportunity there in 1943 to cripple Germany's economy, and it kind of slips past because people don't understand exactly what they've been achieving.
Yeah, at the time, they didn't know, did they?
Yeah. This is
intel weren't there.
Exactly. But one thing that does come out in 1943 is that the Allies coordinate a new target for the bombing, which is going to be round-the-clock bombing. So the US Army Air Force, which is now becoming present in bigger and greater numbers, will do daylight bombing. The Americans insist they can achieve precision. As we already established, precision is 3 miles of the target.
When it comes to bombing, that's never been the Yanks' strong suit, no offence, guys, but...
Yeah. Like, have you ever seen the film Memphis Belle?
No.
It's about, like, a B-17 bomber crew, and they're, like, trying to hit a factory, and there's, like, a school next to it, and they're, like, going around, like, 3 times, like, oh, we have to hit the factory, not the school, and it's like, come on, 3 miles of the target, the fucking school was going up in flames, fucking nuns bouncing in the air. Anyway, so the alignment is the Americans will bomb by day, the Royal Air Force will bomb by night. The Americans believe that the B-17 is well defended enough that it can go up on its own in its formations against fighters. Do you want to have a guess how that works out?
They did have the Flying Fortress, but that's a lot of fighters to go against.
Yeah, like, the Flying Fortress is heavily armed, lots of 50 cal machine guns, but it's going up in daylight, which means, like, you know, the day fighters, the regular single engine fighters, like the BF-109 are going up against it with 30mm cannons, or FW-190s full of 20mm cannons. Very expensive. And it doesn't achieve great results up until February of 1944.
We're getting late now, aren't we?
Yeah, so we're skipping forward a bit. So 1943 is like a bad year for Nazi Germany. I would say it's the year where they lose the war. Everything after that is like, it's reality catching up. You know, 1944 and 1945, what it is, you know, like Roadrunner cartoons where Wile E. Coyote runs off the cliff edge and he runs in the air for a bit, then he realises and he falls down.
Yeah.
This is what 1944... Yeah, yeah. This is them running off the edge just in the air. So in February of 1944, the US Army Air Force commits to Big Week, which is going to be 1 week of hitting Luftwaffe factories. So the aircraft factories, the aviation fuel plants, also like very specific subcomponents like ball bearings are targeted. So they go in big on this to take on the Luftwaffe head to head. One of the problems that's been for daylight bombing is, like you've already mentioned, the range of aircraft, right? So the fighters that are defending the bombers can't fly as far as the bombers, right? And the best kind of way that people have been able to deal with this so far is make bigger fighters, like twin-engined fighters like the BF-110. But the problem is, when you're putting a bigger, heavier plane, it's not as good at being a fighter.
Mm.
And if you're defending...
It's not as agile, not as swift, you know.
So you're attacking, you have to come with a bigger, heavier plane that can go further, but you're coming up against the planes that don't need to travel far. They can be like focused on being agile and heavily armed.
Mm-hmm.
So the twin-engine fighters generally don't have great results. Like BF-110 sucks balls in the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
But the Americans have introduced a new fighter, the P-51 Mustang. Mustang is a single-engine, single-seat fighter. Very good at being a fighter, but the really important thing about it is it has a really long range. Just because it's really aerodynamically clean, it can be fitted with drop tanks so it can go further. And this basically means the Americans can fight one-on-one with the Germans with a plane that is every bit as good or better than the Luftwaffe's standard fighter. So, now the Americans are forcing the Luftwaffe to come out and fight, because it's like, if you don't fight us, we're going to bomb your factories and your airfields and your supplies, or you come and fight and your fighters have to face the P-51. They're coming in huge numbers, and what the Americans also start doing is releasing the fighters. So instead of like having them tightly escorting the bombers,
I'll just go do
exactly.
I suppose the pilots love that.
So go and hunt
more
down.
Effective. It probably would be more effective, wouldn't it?
Like, exactly.
Go get rid of the air defence. Don't just protect us from it. Go get rid of it.
So you're thinking, like, you know, you have a German squadron that's taking off. It's, you know, forming up above the airfield. Suddenly the American fighters are going to appear while you're forming up. They've got energy advantage. You've got speed advantage coming down from altitude. And they can kill you before you're ready to fight.
Yeah. And not plus that, once you're in the air, the German target is the bomber. That's what the focus
exactly.
has gone on.
Exactly.
So, like, they're not going to spot the fighters coming in as easy because the focus is going to be on the bombers.
Exactly. And if they go off to fight the fighters, then it means leaving the bombers to do their shit.
Yeah.
So they've forced the Germans to make some really, like, you know, they have to make bad choices out of bad choices.
Mm.
They don't have good options at this point. And they're coming in their thousands. This is where the productive ability of the Allies is completely overwhelming the Germans. Another consequence of this, you're trying to train your pilots, right? So you take them, your rookie pilots, deep into Germany for them to practice and train, and then suddenly this fucking American fighter screaming down on you.
Mm.
You can't train people. The Allies can do their training in the US and Canada, which is what they're doing. So people already know how to fly before they're coming into battle in Europe.
Mm.
The Germans, now the pipeline's cut. The result of all of this, during February 1944, the Luftwaffe loses one third of all fighter aircraft and one fifth of its crew. Mm. This cripples the Luftwaffe.
I suppose the crew's so high as well, considering they're landing over friendly fucking land every time.
They're on friendly territory, but I mean, it's like, you know, you're going into plane on plane combat, it's inherently risky. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, one third of planes, one fifth. So that's like, what, basically half of planes shot down lose a pilot.
Yeah, that's a lot.
But the thing is,
so that means the planes getting hit are getting destroyed in the air, like completely destroyed.
Exactly. And this isn't one off, this is month after month this continues. Pilot lifespan for the Luftwaffe starts to be measured in weeks.
Wow.
So the Luftwaffe have a handful of extremely experienced, extremely high skill aces, and they have people with a matter of days training and experience, and they have nothing in between. We come into the summer of 1944 and things get even worse for the Nazis. So, obviously, in June of 1944, the Allies land in Normandy on D-Day. And they open the people say second front, but really it's the third or even fourth front. Like, we already have Italy, and I would argue that the air war is the second front.
Mm, definitely.
Like, the resources being put in terms of anti-aircraft guns, aircraft, to try and stop this shit happening. It's the second front for the Germans already. Yeah. So I would argue that the landings in Normandy make it up to four fronts Germany is fighting on. Almost simultaneously with the landing in Normandy, the Soviet army goes on the offensive in Operation Bagration, the massive Red Army offensive that will take them from the Germans occupying the Soviet Union, that will push all the way to Warsaw. Huge offensive. And in terms of like the losses, it massively dwarfs the Normandy battles. One factor in why we, you know, in the UK and the US perceive the Germans as being like this super advanced technological force, you look at the divisions that were sent against Western armies, it was always the Panzer division. So we ended up fighting the tanks and the half-tracks. It was always focused on the West whenever the option was there. The Soviets ended up fighting a lot more of like the horse-drawn divisions, so the Western armies didn't see that as much.
I think probably Kursk, they just lost all the... After Kursk, they lost everything there, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And that's all they had left to follow.
Yeah, and like Bagration like completely destroys the German army in the east.
Yeah,
like they will never recover from this.
Well, the numbers when you look at like how many guns and T-34s were being produced, like you hear the stories, there was like 10 Russian tanks to every one German tank, so every Panther was fighting 10 T-34s.
I can drop you a statistic on this. In 1944, Germany produces 34,000 planes. The Allies together produce nearly 130,000. So like 100,000 plane difference.
It's fucking unbelievable, isn't it? The difference.
Yeah. But this is exactly what everyone had been saying to Hitler since 1936.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, this is what was going to happen.
Fucking open with it.
You know what's going to happen? Exactly what I said would happen. Yeah. This is why I find World War II so frustrating. It's like exactly what everyone said and knew would happen is what ended up happening.
But just loads of people dying.
Loads of people had to die. Fucking millions of people had to die for this to get to...
But what everyone knew was going to happen happened anyway.
Exactly. It's extremely fucking stupid. A consequence of all what's happening with like these big pushes is that Germany is going to have real problems for its fuel now. The Allies begin targeting the synthetic fuel refineries inside Germany, and the Soviets are now pushing the Romanian oil fields, Germany's only source of oil.
I was going to say, that's literally the only place to get oil from at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's no trade coming in from the sea.
Nothing, nothing.
Their only ally with a land border is Romania that's got oil. That would be so important to them.
And in the summer of 1944, they're going to lose this oil source. And at that point...
Nothing works without oil.
Nothing works.
Nothing works without oil.
So everything is crashing down now. Like, the basics building blocks of an economy are, like, you know, you don't have petrol anymore in petrol stations. Even aside from all the destruction that's happening, like, also all of the bullshit economics that have been happening for the last 12 years start coming home to roost. Mm. Inflation is now out of control because, as we've established, money stopped fucking mattering a long time ago.
Yeah.
They are now at, during the autumn of 1944, inflation is at 80%.
This is where all those horror stories come from. I think I mentioned it in the previous episode of like police horses dying in the street and then people mm-hmm. just descend on these horses.
And like butchering the meat off
butcher
of it.
Butchering them in the street.
And it's like they're trying to...
money in barrels and...
Yeah.
It's just not worth anything.
Everything's completely worth it. It also makes it hard to do like assessment economically. Because the money becomes, like, completely fictional at this point. Mm. I mean, obviously, like, there's not great options in fucking German TK Maxx at this point of the war.
Yeah.
But the basics of the civilian economy no longer function. And it's also why you see that workers are being incentivized for, like, good work with, like, cigarettes and clothes. Because cash bonus was meaningless. Like, what's
yeah.
Another consequence of the fact that, like, okay, the front has opened up in Western Europe is airfields in France are being set up and recaptured, which means shorter range planes can now deploy from airfields in France to hit Germany. And where this comes into then is suddenly a focus on the transport network. And it's not just the heavy bombers, but it's like, you know, single-engine planes taken off from France, going and shooting up trains in the Rhineland.
There's a lot of Allied planes, even P-51s.
P-51s and Typhoons, especially.
Just destroying trains, just absolutely obliterating trains. It's really good footage as well, actually.
Yeah, it's off the gun cameras, so it's like recording... what they're shooting at. And yeah, there's shit tons of it, of like trains being shot up. So there's a massive focus then on hitting the transport sector in and out of the Ruhr. So again, to recap, the Ruhr is Germany's main area for iron mining, coal mining. And now it's, you know, the railway hubs are being bombed every night, so the fighters are flying over. There's no longer a Luftwaffe in the air, so the fighter pilots are shooting up trains because there's nothing else to shoot.
Mm.
The bombers are hitting the canal locks and draining the canals. The railway lines, like we said, are getting hit every night. They can't repair it anymore. It's too much pressure going on. Bridges are being blown up. You can't easily repair that. By October, one train in 50 is surviving a journey into the Ruhr.
Wow. It's going out. Well, it was going over a long time ago, but it's just impossible. Well, it's just...
And this is a complete collapse. Yeah, exactly. Nothing will function. It's a complete collapse of the ability of coal to get out from the coal-producing area. And listen, like, we're talking, like, you know, early 20th century economy. Everything runs on coal.
Yeah.
It's like shutting off oil today. Like, nothing works if you shut down the coal. The iron ore can't get out. All of those subcontractors in the Ruhr can't produce anything. By January of 1945, production has completely shut down. BMW and Opel both closed their doors at their main factories. The River Rhine is reported as being clean of pollution for the first time in generations because the factories have stopped working.
Yeah.
The destruction that's inflicted on the Ruhr is so bad that regular coal deliveries in Germany don't recover until 1948.
Wow. There's that much damage done to the system.
That much damage, that much to repair. So, I want to leave with a final point, because I think this next thing we're going to talk about is something that really encapsulates Nazi Germany in fucking microcosm. So, the only way that's left for Germany to hit back at its enemies becomes increasingly outlandish weapons, right? Like, fucking hoping
for Nazi super weapons.
Exactly.
Nazi mega structures.
And in 1944-45, that focus becomes the V2 rocket.
Mm.
Do you want to give the listener some context for what a V2 is?
It's groundbreaking, isn't it, basically. It's a rocket you launch off the floor. It's got like a self-stabilizing mechanism. Obviously, by nowadays standards, it's fucking nothing. But basically, it's a rocket that you can launch from the ground. It self-stabilizes in the air, and then it goes to a pre-chosen target, basically.
It's like it literally looks
incredibly accurately. By nowadays standards, it's not accurate at all. But for the time, it's groundbreaking technology. The most cutting edge. Like, that's the one thing the Germans did fucking... But obviously, it was the German scientists that did it. But it was... That was major.
Yeah. So, I mean, it looks like, you know, the Wallace and Gromit fucking classic.
Oh, yeah, classic missile shape. Yeah, yeah. Pointy at the top, like fucking... You know.
And these are the very, very first rockets to go into space. It's the V2. So... The original Wernher von Braun, who's like the...
Oh, they said, hang on, I'm talking about the same missile, aren't they?
Yeah, like the big, like, black and white... It was used as the first... I think in its wartime thing, it's the first ballistic missile, i.e. goes to space and down. But definitely it was configured after the war by, like, the Soviet and American space agencies. They adapted it to be a space rocket. Yeah, I don't think they did manned flight with it, but it was, like, putting... To test the concept of putting the rocket into space. They used adapted V2s. Wernher von Braun, the Nazi rocket science guy, he got picked up by NASA after the war.
Yeah, I was going to say all the Nazi scientists got picked up, didn't they?
Wernher von Braun was part of the moon program. I think it's a thing that his role gets overstated because people like the story. But it's true, early NASA and especially early Soviet space science is very Nazi.
Yeah.
In the space. Anyway, so the rockets, the V2 first got floated back in 1942, and at that point Hitler's like, this is obvious bullshit. Like, you want to spend all this money on a rocket that's really not that accurate, doesn't carry that much explosive, and what's the point? But Albert Speer, however, saw value, because bombing cities was the Luftwaffe's shop, right? Mm. And the Luftwaffe was the one thing that wasn't in Speer's hands. So he saw an opportunity that the V2 can be the army's thing, and I can make the strategic bombing of cities my thing.
Yeah, okay.
Because, as we said, Albert Speer is like just a shit middle manager at a shit company. Yeah. That's who he is. So he was all over the V2 for this reason. By 1943, this has gone from being a stupid idea to the last desperate hope. Maybe if we use this rocket, maybe they'll make peace with us.
Mm.
The Germans pour 14 billion Reichsmark into this project. Adapted to US dollars, this is the single most expensive weapon of World War II. Is to say, it is more expensive than the atomic bomb.
Wow.
Which is the one actual super weapon of World War II. So, huge cost they pour into this thing. And obviously the bombs are raining down on Germany, so they build this underground factory, this huge tunnel complex at a place called Mittelbau, and it's going to produce V2s, and it's also going to produce jet engines for the first jet fighter, the ME-262. So they carve out this huge tunnel complex. And when I say they, what I mean is slave labour taken from the Jewish population of Europe and Soviet POWs are going to dig tunnels. As you can imagine, health and safety does not apply. No space was made in those tunnels for housing. But the workforce, again, slave labour, thousands of people would work, live, sleep underground without seeing daylight for weeks at a time. There would be no clean water in the tunnels for them to wash or drink. And to motivate the workforce, those who did not work fast enough would be hanged from the rafters of the tunnels and left as like a sign to the rest of the workforce. We mentioned last time that Albert Speer got away by claiming he didn't know the Holocaust happened, right? Albert Speer visited the plant personally. And I think this is probably the best image to leave this series on. Like, I mean, we could continue a bit more into the collapse, but I think this idea of an underground tunnel, people hiding from bombs raining down every night, a tunnel full of corpses manned by slaves that the Nazis considered racially inferior, building rockets with basically no military value to fight a war that's already been lost. That's the Nazi economy. That's Nazi Germany. And to me, I think that's the image I would leave it on. Because that just encapsulates every fucking nonsense that the Nazis are trying to achieve.
That's a real depressing note to leave a top series on.
Thank you.
It's been hard, to be fair, isn't it?
It's been a difficult one.
It's been an emotional rollercoaster, this has.
Big time. It has been upsetting to do the research, to be honest.
We made it to the end.
We did it, and if you've listened to this and listened this far, thank you for sticking with us through.
They're fucking play to us, to be fair.
Something like 14 hours of fucking misery.
Yeah, I've mentioned it before. We're going to go down to like a sort of less per season. We're going to cover more topics, basically, in a short period of time. But this is such a large topic.
Yeah.
You know, to do any sort of justice, it'd have to be over this kind of time span.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, like, you know, we could continue the series in more detail, but I think this episode captures how fucking reality came home for the Nazis really fucking quickly.
Yeah. Like we said, we've said many times, it just shows how ridiculous this whole fucking situation was. A world, hopefully we'll never have one again. I know it looks like we're knocking on the door, but hopefully this never happens again. Because it was all over nothing, and you'd think we would have learned from the first one. But seriously, Ross, you put a fucking lot of effort into this, mate. You've done really well with it, a lot of good content. Obviously, that's why everyone listens. You know, there's a lot of really good content, mate. So fair play to you. You've done really well with this.
Thank you very much.
Looking forward to that. We don't even discuss what the next series is, have we? Or if we decided, I can't remember.
I mean, I've decided. I don't know.
What we're going with, then we'll give them a little teaser.
I think we're going to go something medieval.
Oh, no, it's okay. Yeah, I'll dig that. Yeah. How medieval?
I want to do something on some late medieval France. I've got some nice ideas of where we're going with this. I've got a little story of 100 years, 5 people. It's going to be a nice one.
Nice. Wicked. I suppose that's the roundup of it, isn't it?
It's the roundup.
It was miserable. Thanks for listening. As always, you can hit us up on X. Are we on that still or not?
Yeah, no, for the time being, X. We are at Makers of History on the X with the Xitter, Jitter, whatever.
I think we need to go on OnlyFans.
I mean, I already am.
Sexy Ross, history boy.
Can you imagine how fucking depressing my OnlyFans would be?
History boy, B-O-R. Don't actually be a username, bro.
Just describing the conditions in Nazi factories. Yeah, like, it's like ASMR, but
for fucking murderers. Right.
All right.
That's it, guys. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. who are listening, I know it's been a long way, but we finally got there. Here we go. We're going to go medieval next time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. See you later, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.